for What's Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Taliban attacks rock Afghan capital and blast kills more than 30 in northeastern Nigeria. I'm Bill Michaels in Washington. An explosion followed by extended gunfire has rocked the embassy district of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Details of the attack Thursday are still not clear, but it came just hours after a British embassy vehicle was hit by a suicide car bomb, killing a British security guard, an Afghan member of the embassy staff, and three others. Taliban claim responsibility for the attack, as well as blasts that shook a diplomatic area in Kabul late Thursday. Local officials said the blast wounded at least 33 people, most of them Afghan civilians. Witnesses say an explosion on a busy road in northeastern Nigeria has killed more than 30 people. The blast happened Thursday at the Mararaba Mubai Junction in Adamawa State. Authorities tell VOA they're unsure whether the explosion was an accident possibly caused by a soldier carrying a bomb or an attack by a suicide bomber. More than 130 people have been killed in tribal clashes in Sudan's oil-rich region near the border with South Sudan. There is no immediate comment from Sudan's government. Researchers say an experimental Ebola vaccine has caused no serious side effects and produced an immune response in all 20 healthy volunteers who received it in an early-stage clinical trial. The New England Journal of Medicine said Wednesday that scientists will continue to follow the volunteers for another 48 weeks in the study that began on September 2nd. This is VOA News. The global oil cartel OPEC has decided to maintain current levels of production despite a worldwide oil glut that has driven market prices down more than 30% since June. On news of the decision taken Thursday in Vienna by the 12-nation Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the price of the benchmark Brent crude fell an additional $4 to a four-year low of $73 a barrel. The OPEC meeting, widely seen as one of the most crucial in years, came as shale oil production continues to surge in the United States. Forecasters say U.S. shale extraction will produce an additional 1 million barrels a day this year and add another million barrels a day in 2015. Syrian warplanes have carried out more airstrikes on Raqqa, the main city held by the Islamic State group. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says a number of civilians were killed and others wounded in one of these strikes on a house belonging to a judge. The monitoring group says other attacks targeted schools, a hospital, an Islamic State checkpoint, and a building taken over by IS militants. The Reuters news agency reports seven people were killed in the latest strikes, including five from one family. The observatory has said at least 95 people were killed Tuesday, including 52 in attacks in Raqqa. The International Committee of the Red Cross is appealing for a record $1.68 billion to help millions of people whose lives are torn apart by armed conflict and violence. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the nature of armed conflict is changing. ICRC President Peter Morris says new kinds of crises are emerging in new combinations, often with a regional dimension.
We see international armed conflict, internal armed conflict, criminal violence, intercommunal violence, superpositioning itself in the same context.
Morris says the conflict in Syria has long ceased to be a civil war. It has become a regional crisis engulfing Iraq, Lebanon, and Jordan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ukraine's new parliament held its first session Thursday since elections last month, in which constituents voted overwhelmingly for pro-Western parties. Nearly three-quarters of the deputies in the 450-seat body voted to keep Arseniy Yatsenyuk as the country's prime minister. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Namibia holds presidential and national assembly election today, Friday.
We have already placed measurement. The first and most important one is that the commission itself is mandated under our constitution to conduct and to direct free, fair, and credible elections.
Paul Isaac is the chief executive officer of Namibia's Electoral Commission. A new report says most African countries will not reach their Millennium Development Goals in 2015. South Sudan bishops call on government and rebels to end their nearly year-long conflict, and Togolese opposition parties and civil society groups call for a massive protest today, Friday.
They are claiming for political reforms so that elections in Togo can be free and fair, because they say it's a human right to have free and fair elections.
Kojo Dilava is the Secretary General of the main opposition National Alliance for Change Party in Togo. A satellite tracker throws light on gas flaring in Nigeria, and Nairobi vendors face legal hurdles and physical violence. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Namibia's Electoral Commission says it has implemented measures to ensure the presidential and national assembly elections scheduled to be held today, Friday, will be credible. Paul Isaac, chief executive officer of the electoral body, says the commission has dispatched voting materials across the country. Isaac tells reporter Peter Clotty that the Electoral Commission is mandated under the Constitution to organize free, fair, transparent, and credible elections.
Already we have started, we are deploying all the sensitive and non-sensitive materials to various regions and constituencies.
Has the Electoral Commission been able to address concerns of all political parties in the run-up to the elections Friday?
Yes, actually, our modus operandi in connection with the political parties is, first of all, we consider them as our major stakeholders. That basically means that we are in regular meetings with them. At the same time, also, like the ballot papers and all the electoral voting machines and all those issues, before it is dispatched, that basically means there is a constant flow of information between the Electoral Commission of Namibia as well as the political parties.
Professor Isaac, what measures has your organization, the Electoral Commission, implemented or is implementing to ensure a credible election?
Yes, we have already in place measurement. The first and most important one is that the commission itself is mandated to conduct under our constitution, which is a democratic constitution, that constitutionally we have the mandate to conduct and to direct free, fair, and credible elections, and that we take seriously and we are working accordingly.
Some opposition groups are saying that the campaigning ahead of the election has not been fair and that the ruling party appear to be using state resources and all that. Have you addressed those concerns?
Yes, I would say that in Namibia, generally speaking, from one corner, from east to west and from the north to south, Namibia has always, whether it is elections or not, has always have a very peaceful atmosphere. And also all the political parties are living peacefully together, generally speaking, in the country. Also, I do not deny the fact that sometimes here and there, but it was isolated cases where political parties in certain parts of the country were a little bit fighting on issues such as where to host a flag or where to put a poster, those kinds of things. But this, I have also to say, is not in the political party per se, but it is in individuals which belongs to certain political parties, but also not at a very large scale.
Paul Isaac is the Chief Executive Officer of the Electoral Commission of Namibia. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Windhoek. A Togolese opposition official says he does not wish for a Burkina Faso-style popular uprising in Togo, but Kojo Dileva, Secretary General of the main opposition National Alliance for Change Party, says if President Faure Gnassingbé continues to refuse to implement political reforms that will lead to a presidential term limit and free and fair election, then a Burkina Faso-style popular uprising might happen. This comes as a coalition of opposition parties and civil society groups have called for a mass protest today, Friday, to demand reforms ahead of next year's general election. Dileva says the protesters want a return to the 1992 constitution, which calls for a two-term presidential term limit.
The demonstration is organized by the human rights activist organizations in Togo. They are claiming for political reforms so that election in Togo can be free and fair, because they say it's a human right to have free and fair election so that people can choose their leader free and fairly. And there are some political reform scheduled on behalf of a political agreement since the year 2006. This agreement was signed by all political parties, and up to now, Mr. Faure Gnassingbé, who is the head of state, is not showing any will to implement those reforms.
Do these reforms that are being requested, do they include a presidential term limit?
Yeah, the reform includes a wide range of reform, including basically limitation, mandate limitation, and a two rounds poll. We call it election à deux tours, scrutin à deux tours.
As you said, the current constitution does not call for a term limit, and President Faure Gnassingbé has said he wants to uphold the current constitution. How can you bring about change?
You see, the agreement I was talking about is an agreement which Togolese political leader signed in 2006. And according to this agreement, Faure Gnassingbé was committed to make those reforms so that election in Togo can be free and fair and pacific without army intervention, without fraud, so that to minimize irregularities.
In neighboring Burkina Faso, former President Blaise Compaoré tried to change the constitution, and the people rose up against him. Are you hoping that in Togo, similar thing would happen?
I'm not hoping it will happen, but there is a chance it can happen. This is not our hope, but if Faure Gnassingbé continues to refuse to implement political reforms so that election can be free and fair, so that presidential mandate can be limited, maybe it will happen.
Kojo Dileva is the Secretary General of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. Nigeria produces more oil than anywhere else in Africa, and with that comes natural gas, much of which is burned off by oil companies in a practice called gas flaring. But just how much gas is flared? Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja, on a new tool that will allow the government and anyone else who is interested to see where and how much gas is being burned in Nigeria.
Gas flares are a common sight in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta region. But for years, there has been no way of telling who has been flaring, where it has been happening, and how much natural gas has been going up in flames. Now, there is. The Gas Flare Tracker is a website that allows governments and anyone else who is curious to see how much gas is being flared across the Niger Delta. Using satellite data, the website displays a map showing all the gas flares in the region, with details about the gas being burned. Andrew Lewis is a technical consultant to the United Kingdom's Department for International Development who worked on the project. He says the tracker shows how much gas is being burned that could be used to generate power in a country where reliable, round-the-clock electricity is practically non-existent.
And the gas power generation potential is absolutely staggering. Just over 27, actually very close to 28,000 gigawatts. As has already been said, that would provide at least 40% of Nigeria's total electricity requirements.
Minister for Environment Laurencia Laraba Malam says for years, Nigeria did not have data like this, and therefore did not know how much gas was being burned.
We didn't have anything. You heard the DG said, or the MC said, anytime we attend foreign conferences, you know, we hear other countries tell the amount, you know, of gas, you know, released into the atmosphere. But we guess. But from today, we will not guess. We will give the correct amount because of this tracker.
Better data could allow Nigeria to force oil companies to pay up for the gas they release. By law, oil companies are supposed to pay $3.50 per 1,000 standard cubic feet of gas burned. But Peter Idabor, Director General of the National Oil Spill Detection and Response Agency, says companies skirt by without paying their fair share.
We believe that the companies are not giving us, they're not paying accurate taxes from the volumes of gas they are supposed to apply, because you can see they give you a table showing those amounts. But right now we'll be able to know the total amount of gas fled in relation to the tax they are paying, and then the deficit they'll be made to pay.
Idabor hopes more stringent enforcement of fines will encourage companies to use gas for things like power generation, rather than burning it off and releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, November 28th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. Most African countries will not reach the Millennium Development Goals set for 2015 because of the gap between economic and human development. That is one of the conclusions in this year's United Nations annual report on the least developed countries, presented yesterday, Thursday. Martha van der Wolf reports from the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa.
Despite economic growth on the African continent in the last decade, most African countries will not reach the Millennium Development Goals by next year. UN Economic Affairs Officer for Africa, Junior Davis, says African countries have not been able to translate their economic growth into structural transformation.
And we think that is the case because these countries have not focused sufficiently on building what we call their productive capacities. These are the basic human and economic development capacities that are needed to promote sustainable economic development. And the Millennium Development Goals, as they were constructed, largely ignored the need to develop productive capacities.
African countries are also not on course to halve poverty by 2015, and their overall progress on reducing hunger is relatively slow. Poverty limits human development and undermines productivity, and economic development is needed to make gains in human development. Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, and Malawi are the only four African countries on track to reach the majority of the development goals. They are making progress because they heavily invested in areas that create sustainable development, such as infrastructure, health, and education. The post-2015 development agenda for fragile countries where governance remains an issue, such as South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo, will still largely depend on support from the international community to achieve social and economic development, says Davis.
So we look at things like rural development, improving the level of productivity in industry and agriculture and the services sector, and at looking at ways in which we can have pattern of growth, which is not just sustainable, but jobs rich. Because we see the growth in jobs and employment as central to any development strategy that aims to reduce poverty in a sustainable way.
A country is placed on the least developed countries list based on its per capita income, economic vulnerability, and human development indicators such as health and nutrition. Of the 48 least developed countries in the world, 34 are in Africa. Three countries have graduated from their least developed status: Botswana, Cape Verde, and Samoa. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Anglican bishops in South Sudan have called on the government and the rebels to end the nearly one-year conflict in their country. Bishop Anthony Pargo says majority Christians in the country are urging church leaders to press warring parties to sign a peace deal. He says the church is concerned about the suffering of the people of South Sudan because of the conflict.
As bishops, we looked at the ongoing involvement in the church on what how the treaty would look like in terms of our own preparation, in terms of ways of how we can alleviate the suffering of our people through poverty. We looked at ways in which the church can contribute towards that.
They say the difference between politics and religion is very thin. How about the political situation in the country? Did the bishops talk about it?
Well, we are concerned basically about the suffering of our people, both in South Sudan and, of course, the ongoing war in Sudan. We did talk about that. As you know, that the faith groups have been having observer status, ongoing talks in Addis, and so we were concerned. We wanted to hear, you know, from one of the representatives, one of our bishops actually has been one of the observers, and we wanted to hear from him firsthand, but also give our own input, because we are keen that the suffering of our people is brought to an end. And one of the things that we talked about was the need for the two sides to expeditiously sign peace agreement so that the suffering of our people is brought to an end.
Bishop Enoch Tombe is representing the faith-based groups in Addis Ababa. What did he tell the bishops about what is happening in Addis? Because the talks have been on and off.
Like all of us, I think he also shares with us as bishops our concern on the need to expedite the process. And, of course, as an observer, it's not much that he can do apart from urging the two sides to speed up the process. This is definitely the issue that we are all concerned. So our plea is to the two sides to look at the issues that are a stumbling block to a final settlement of the problems that have affected this country.
If the church is given an opportunity to resolve this conflict in South Sudan today, how would you go about resolving it?
Look at the root causes of what has been happening to this nation and what has contributed to what we've gone through. Negative ethnicity is definitely one of the issues, although there are root causes which definitely need to be looked into. And I think handling some of those issues would be crucial as a long-term solution to what has contributed to where we are now.
That was Anglican Bishop Anthony Pargo speaking from Juba to John Tanzel via South Sudan in Focus program. The Nairobi City Council has been accused of brutality in dealing with hawkers in the central business district in order to stop them from illegally selling their wares on the streets. Lenny Ruvaga has more for VOA News from the Kenyan capital.
Hawkers scamper away to escape almost daily raids by Nairobi City Council officers, commonly referred to as askaris. Kenya's capital is home to approximately 3,000 street vendors, many of them without legal permits. Business permits in Nairobi, varying in costs from $100 to $1,000, too expensive for the small street vendor. As an alternative, the city council has designated spots where hawkers can sell their goods for a daily fee of about $1. Here, at this alternative market, there are more vendors than space, and the congestion forces many to sell illegally on the streets. Paul Njoroge has been a street vendor for 5 years and says it's the only way he can make a living and support his family.
In a day, if the city council doesn't harass us, we can make between $5 and $10. That is enough money, and we don't need to rely on government handouts. For the young hawkers, this is better than turning to crime. We are only trying to make an honest living.
Honest, maybe, but still running afoul of city regulations. Askari raids have turned more aggressive over the last few years. Muihia Nduati, an official from the Nairobi Central Business District Hawkers Association, or NCBDHA, says the raid tactics are unnecessarily violent.
When we look at issues concerning human rights, the city council grossly violates these rights when they use brutal force to apprehend hawkers. And it is not only hawkers who get injured. When police do things like hurl broken bottles at the hawkers, bystanders get injured.
Despite repeated efforts to reach out to the Nairobi City Council, the council would not give an official comment on the allegations. Established 4 years ago, the Kenya National Commission of Human Rights, or KNCHR, has now gotten involved in the issue. Kagwiri Mbogori, the KNCHR chairperson, spoke to VOA.
Some of the approaches of the city inspectorate towards the hawkers, I think it has surpassed what is allowable within the legal framework. It is, I would say, irregular amounts of violence to the extent of killing, maiming, or otherwise injuring hawkers.
The KNCHR has registered more than 20 complaints from hawkers in the last year alone and has filed 3 cases with the court for excessive violence. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Guinea are Africa's most improved national team, while Egypt have slipped by the widest margin, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Ranked 18th, Algeria's Desert Fox are Africa's highest-placed team. Tunisia is 22nd, Ivory Coast 24th, Senegal 35th, Ghana 37th, Guinea 38th, Cameroon 41st, African champions Nigeria 42nd, Mali 49th, and South Africa 51st. In Ghana, Israeli tactician Avram Grant is the new Ghana Black Stars head coach. The Ghana Football Association president Akwesi Nyantegi disclosed in Accra on Thursday. Grant assumes duty on Monday, having signed a 3-year contract. Nyantegi says while it may prove unrealistic for Grant to lead Ghana to victory at the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, they expect him to guide the Black Stars to win the 2017 Nations Cup. Meanwhile, Ghana lost their appeal against disqualification from the 2015 Orange African Under-17 Championships, the Confederation of African Football revealed in Cairo, Egypt on Thursday. The Ghanaians were initially disqualified for fielding Asiedu Benjamin Kwesi and Tuwum Isaacs in their qualifier against Cameroon on the 13th of September as they were accused of being overage. Subsequent magnetic resonance imaging MRI scans cleared Kwesi. However, Isaacs failed a second test. Therefore, Ghana is replaced by Cameroon at the Africa Under-17 Championships due in Niamey, Niger. In Ivory Coast, lethal striker Roger Assali, the most valuable player in the Ivory Coast Premier League, leads Sewe Sports attack when they host Egypt's El Ahly in the opening leg of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup final in Abidjan tomorrow Saturday. Assali has 4 goals to his credit in the Confederations Cup campaign. Sewe Sports are up against Africa's most successful club, El Ahly, who have won 18 Orange African Champions League titles and an Afro Asian Cup. El Ahly's impressive trophy cabinet confirmed them as having won more international trophies than any club in the world. Italy's AC Milan and Argentina's Boca Juniors are second and third respectively. Nonetheless, the new look El Ahly side seek to break new grounds by becoming the first Egyptian club to win the Orange Africa Confederations Cup. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Witnesses say an explosion on a busy road in northeastern Nigeria has killed more than 30 people. And that's it for this Friday, November 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Owoman, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Butte, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.